and welcome to episode 2 of Why Shakespeare, a podcast that asks people why they like, or as a matter of fact, do not like Shakespeare, why it might be important to them, why they do it, study it, play it, or shun it, and why it is still relevant today. My name is Victoria, and I am your host. I'm a writer and a theatre director with a passion for Shakespeare. People always ask me, but why Shakespeare? So I thought I'd return the favour. My guest today is the actor and writer Michael Begley. He has been acting for decades and has countless credits on the West End and in theatres across the country. He has been on television in Doctor Who, Holby City, Casualty, Call the Midwife and EastEnders, for which he has also written several episodes, as Michael is a talented play and screenwriter. I interviewed him in his dressing room in Xi'an's Grand Opera House in China, not far from the Emperor's Terracotta Army, if that rings a bell, as we were touring together for 3 months with Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None. This was back in June 2024. That's right, that's almost a year ago now. And that's how long it took me to get this podcast on the road. But here we go. The wait is finally over. I hope you enjoy our chat just as much as I did. The trigger warnings for this episode include some light swearing. Dressing room in the city of Xi'an in China today on the 12th of June 2024, 425 years after the first globe, Shakespeare's globe, opened on the South Bank.
Are you going to do a dance? Because you did a dance on Shakespeare's birthday.
Shall I do it?
Okay, for all those people who can't see, which is everybody apart from me. Victoria just did a dance in this very swanky dressing room.
Very swanky. I did a dance this morning when I woke up, actually, when my phone reminded me that the globe opens today, and I thought, how serendipitous.
Yes.
We've been on tour in China for 6 weeks, and yesterday something prompted me to ask you to give me a bit of your time to talk about Shakespeare.
Which makes no sense, and I want to ask about that before you ask me about other things. Like, I've not really done Shakespeare, so that's like the shortest podcast ever, isn't it?
Thank you, Michael. That was great.
That's like, damn. I suppose I want to ask as well, why are you so excited about Shakespeare? Why do you dance whenever these big round numbers come?
I think, for me, Shakespeare is the closest I've ever got in life or art or any other experience to experiencing in my body the fullest range of human emotion.
Wow.
It's the most complete human experience. And you only need to sit there for about 3 hours. It's a commitment, don't get me wrong. It's a commitment to sit there for 3 hours. You know, you get up at the interval and you have a glass of rosé and you pee. But When it's done well, when the magic happens, just wow. It explains why we're alive and what we want to do and why we think the way we think and why we feel the way we feel. He's not so much about the thinking as about the feeling and about explaining to you how life works. And it's so mysterious and magic and bizarre that the only way you can explain why we feel the way we feel is through poetry.
Yeah. Good answer.
Why do you? So, I mean, it's a good question because you've told me from the start. You're like, nah, Shakespeare's not my thing. It's not my thing. I'm doing this Michael Begley gesture for those of us who can't see. But why? Why isn't it your thing?
Well, I don't know. That's the honest answer. So why? That's a good question. Why? So for me, in my mind, there are many Shakespeares. When I was little, I used to think there were two Elvises. I used to think that there was young, beautiful Elvis who was in all of the films and made my mum turn into mush. And then there was fat Elvis who looked like a waxwork and was sort of wheeled on, and in my mind I was literally like, there's no way, that's not Elvis. That's not the same Elvis. There's no way that that Elvis can be the Elvis who's got the hips and all that kind of stuff. And actually, if you think about it, there's only like, 13 years between those two Elvises, because that's how quickly he deteriorated. And in my life, I have that with Shakespeare. I read Shakespeare's poetry, I guard it jealously because it's so beautiful. And I feel all of those things that you just said very eloquently about it. It expresses so much about what it is to be alive and more. And then I go and see it. And I just think, that's not that guy that I read like at home. That's just not that. And I suppose that the honest answer is that I've been to so many dead, wooden, boring, 3 hour, yes, 3 hour, felt every minute, right? I've been to a lot of that kind of stuff and it didn't speak to me. But there were flashes where some of the famous speeches and some of the famous poetry was spoken well, but it didn't penetrate me or speak to me in the way that it did when I was at home reading it.
What happens when you're at home reading it?
Well, I discovered him late. I grew up at a time where naturalism was the thing. And the reasons that I wanted to become an actor was because I'd watched films that were made in black and white in this country in the 1960s of actors like Albert Finney and Tom Courtney. They were just very good at telling stories about working class lives, which were like my own, that spoke to me. A Taste of Honey, Billy Liar, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. Those films really spoke to me. They were also happening on television in lots of ways. And I was studying that and I was learning about that. And then I suppose there was a second wave of that with actors like Gary Oldman and Tim Roth. And Mike Leigh was making lots of films. And to me, that was what I was called to be and to do. I thought, in my own little private way, maybe I could be that kind of actor and be in stories that were about what it was like to grow up in a country where you didn't have much and everybody I knew was either a builder or a scaffolder or worked in a supermarket or was a dustman. Those were the people that I was surrounded by because my parents were Irish, they'd come over on a boat, they didn't have any academic aspirations.
You told me, walking here, you told me this lovely thing where your family, how did you put it? You put it so beautifully, you know, about what you do. Your family's like, well, we don't understand it. Good luck.
Yeah, I mean, it's even worse than that, Victoria. When I told my dad is at that time he was a bricklayer, but that's not fair to him as well. I don't want to be reductive. He's a philosopher as well. He's the sort of man who would sit out on the patio at night, on the decking, and he'd look into the middle distance and he'd say things to me like, "Where does all the sound go?" And I'd be like, "I don't know, Dad." And I thought very deeply about things. But yeah, there was absolutely no context for anybody going into anything. Well, they wouldn't even know what the arts were. I mean, what does that even mean? Wouldn't know what that was. Mm. Never really occurred to anyone else in my house that you could be inside the television. It's just something you watched.
That you could make a living out of it as
yeah,
well.
We didn't know anyone who did that. Yeah. That was not anything that would ever occur to anyone. Yeah.
How are you going to live? How are you going to pay the bills? Yeah. How are you
going to... So when I told my dad, bear in mind that he'd taken me out on jobs to do. Sometimes he'd take me out on a Saturday and I'd help out with the building. The first time that I did that, I turned off somehow all of the lights in the street. And he said to me then, he said, if anyone else apart from you, I would fire you. But just go and sit in the van. And so when I did finally say to him, Dad, I'm going to go away and train to be an actor, he looked at me, not with any hostility or anything, it was just very neutral. He just looked at me and he said, I was wondering what you were. not in a positive or negative way, just that, just I don't know what you are, I don't know, and I never have, and now you've said that, actually, yeah, I was one that makes sense, kind of thing. But yeah, no one was able to offer me any sort of help. So
when you came to Shakespeare with that path, I guess it must have felt so alien and weird.
What I'm trying to lead up to say is, in one sentence, is Shakespeare was something that posh people did.
Yeah.
And that was it. And that was all it meant to me. And if you'd have asked me then, I'd have said that to you. I'd have just looked at you with non-comprehension and said, "Well, that's just something that posh people like. I'm not about that. I don't have any credentials for that. So just let me get on being like the new Gary Oldman." Because that's what I want to do. That's all I want. So I wouldn't even understand why you were asking me about it. But then, of course, everything's more complex, isn't it, than we make it. So at the same time, I'm at school, I'm doing English literature, I'm good at it.
Yeah.
And there's teachers who are saying...
You have a way with words.
Well, there's teachers saying, you know, the thing you wrote the other day was really good. So I'm getting encouraged to do that. And those teachers can see things that I can't. So we read Othello. Don't know what that's about. It's got a black guy in it. We're reading it. This Othello guy is like really jealous. He's well jealous about this young wife that he's got, which, you know, I'm beginning to understand. He just thinks everybody wants to get with his wife, right? So then the English teacher says, "Michael, why don't you read Iago?"
Okay.
Same English teacher that said the stuff you wrote last week is quite funny. So I get to read it in class. I think it was probably the first time I ever got lost in reading something out loud. There's a certain thing of like, I'm reading now, and I'm talking out loud, and everyone can hear my voice and stuff like that. But there was something about this person and the way they were manipulating their friend in a way that wasn't friendly that made me lose myself in it, and I really enjoyed reading it. I knew that it was enjoyable because people were laughing. I could see, I could hear that. And I really liked that. And so that got me really interested in just that play. Didn't broaden out to anything else at that time. But I remember thinking, oh, that's really delicious. That man in that play can say those things to his friend, make him feel so awful, and then turn to the audience and say, "Did you see what I did there?" Right? And I understood it. And then for the first time, I crossed that little bridge of understanding where I thought, yeah, I understand what the writer's doing there. And it was that. I think that was the first sight. So it's a paradox. I'm still in my head going, that's something that posh people do.
Yeah.
And yet, there's something else there that I can see, but I'm just going, oh, well, maybe it's just that one. Maybe it's just that play.
I'm really interested in the reading out loud bit, because I think it's something a lot of people I seem to talk to or meet. It's very different to have to sit through Shakespeare or read Shakespeare in your room, but something happens when you read it out loud. Yes. Something happens to you when you put it in your body and get to experience what the words do to you.
Yes.
And what do you think that is? What do you think, like, that's when the magic happens? Like, that's when the eggs become something else. I don't know why that's the metaphor that I have.
Yeah.
It's like baking.
Yeah.
You have eggs and flour and milk.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, all right. But then when you put it together, it creates this incredible thing.
I used to say it. When I was doing that thing you were talking about where I was going, it's not for me, it's not something I do. I used to have it as a little kind of, just one of my little things that I say just to kind of dismiss things. I used to say, it's more fun to do than watch. I used to say that all the time. And in a sense, that's true, because I don't want to generalize too much, but many times I've been to see things where it didn't touch me at all. And then I'd go home and I'd look at that and I'd do it in my room and read it to myself, and it's all there. And so I don't know what that thing is about, but you're right, it is a different thing. And it does come back to that thing I was talking about there being two Elvises or two Shakespeares. The personal Shakespeare and then the public Shakespeare, where it's all just kind of going on around you and people kind of slapping their thighs and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like, and they're very different to me. They were very different to me at that age. Iago got me, he got me. And then I found out that there was another character that talked to the audience and did that stuff. I found that out much later. I found that out at drama school. So now I'm at drama school and all anybody seems to talk about is Shakespeare. And
when was this?
So I got into acting really late. I was 19, I was at college, and I made friends with the art teacher. At that time, everybody thought I was going to be a graphic designer because I'm very good at drawing, but only in a reproductive way, only in a draftsman way of like, I can make a crushed Coke can look really crushed and like a Coke can. I spent all my time in the art room. And the truth is, I was a chameleon as well, and I was not dealing very well with being a chameleon. It's very confusing being like 17, 18 anyway. But when you're a chameleon and you can be any colour you want to be, it's horrendous.
How do you ground yourself?
Yeah, and I was confusing other people and I was very confused myself. So I just stayed in the art room, mainly because I liked the sound of the rain on the roof. And this man took an interest in me. He was an art teacher, he was called Mr. Hall. He was a very good art teacher. And sometimes we would have lunch together, and I am a very bland eater, which is why I'm finding China very hard. And in those days, I'd only eat cheese or ham sandwiches and white bread, and that's all I ever ate. I never ate anything else. And he would sit and we'd talk about how strange that was sometimes. And then other times, he would get me talking about old films. And one day, very important phrase in any story, one day, mm-hmm. I was talking about a movie called The Treasure of Sierra Madre. Humphrey Bogart movie. There was an actor in those movies called Walter Brennan, and he was like the actor that everyone recognises. There's gold in them there hills. He sounds like it. All the characters that everyone always thinks is in a Western, he's that actor. But he was actually a really young man who played older parts, a bit like Clive Dunn in Dad's Army and a show here. And I was talking about that, and I was talking about the film, and he suddenly stopped me. And it was the first time anyone had sort of done an intervention with me. This first time, actually, thinking back to it, I never actually made this distinction. He may arguably have been my first middle-class friend, right? So it's the first time anyone had the awareness to say, stop. So I stopped, and he said, this is abnormal, this is unusual. Why do you know so much about these old films? And I didn't know. I didn't know the answer. I just wanted to carry on with my story. And he said, no, you know lots. Every day you talk about things like this. And he was the first person who ever said to me, you're a writer or an actor or something. You're something. And you need to do that. You need to get involved with that. And I said, no, I've seen those performing artists, people, they're like really loud. and he said, no, they're not. He said, they have a lot of fun. I said, no, they're really loud. I've seen them. And he said, you need to come down with me. I'll take you down there. They're doing a production right now. I'll take you down there tonight. I panicked. I was like, no, I don't want to do that. And he said, don't worry. It's cast. You can't be in it. He's like, it's done. So he took me down there. He said, you can help me paint the set. So that night we went down. And sure enough, they were all there. There was a lion and a scarecrow and some girl in gingham. And we painted this yellow brick road, painted it, and they were all singing and stuff, and there was an orchestra, and they were all like, I was just hanging around in the background thinking, this is a really strong thing. They were really loud. And then, so I'm doing that for a couple of days, and I was invisible, you know, no one could see me or anything like that. It was just like in the dark. And so I'm in charge of the Wicked Witch of the West revolving bridge, and I had to turn it a few degrees and make sure it's in the right position. And then I even got involved with the stage management. And at the end of Act One, we have a sort of a wardrobe, which is in Auntie M's house in Kansas. And then I painted the Emerald City inside, and then we opened it out like that, and it becomes the Emerald City. It's quite a neat change for a student production. You only do it for 4 nights. And on the third night, that was the night that changed my life, because we opened the wardrobe from off stage with a string, so it looked like it was opening by itself, and it would get a little round of applause from the audience because it was such a nice little trick. And on the third night, the string broke, and there was no way to physically change the scenery. Someone had to go on and change it, and there was no one else available. And so they said, you have to go on and do it. And so I went on, and it was the first time I'd ever stood in the lights. And first thing I noticed was I couldn't see anything. And it was only about 8 steps to the thing that I needed to do. And I could have just walked on and just opened the wardrobe and walked off, but I didn't. Something else happened. It was very mysterious, very strange. I just knew what to do. And I knew what they wanted. It was like I could get inside their heads and I knew what they wanted to see. They didn't want to see someone just carry on and open the thing. They wanted someone to look like they didn't know what to do. And so I started to do this thing, and years later I would find out that that thing was called clowning. What I did was I started to talk to an imaginary person in the wings and go, and then look at the audience and then go, nah, like that. And then it got a laugh, it got a little laugh, because they could tell I wasn't sure whether I should be there or not. And then I kept pointing at the wardrobe and going, what, that one, like that. And then that got a laugh. And then I'd take another couple of steps and stop and go talk back to the person in the wings who wasn't there. It was only in my head. I'd go, are you sure it's that one? I'd get another laugh. I did that about 3 or 4 times. I got more and more confident. And then opened the door. And of course the door would open straight away, but I had to be like, open it. Like, right? So that's the thing, right? And then eventually did it. And then looked at the audience. They looked at me, I looked at them. And I just walked off. I sat down in the wings. My heart was beating. Adrenaline, of course. But on another level, I felt supernaturally calm. I felt like I had come to a place where I'd always been destined to be, and I'd just done what was needed to be done. Mm-hmm. That moment was the most mysterious of my life, and it's taken me 32 years to quite unravel it and work out what happened. But what happened was that I became a performer. And what was really interesting was that the audience knew almost a moment before me that I was a performer, and I just kind of went, oh, of course, like that. And so the very next thing that happened after I sat down was that all of the pretty girls who I'd been completely invisible to came running around and said, that was amazing, how did you do that? You didn't even say anything and you got like loads of love. And that was another problem that would take me years to unravel. But that was the thing that happened then. So I had all of that. I knew that was in place. But Shakespeare wouldn't fit into that. I couldn't find a way of making all of that stuff you talked about that was true fit into that thing. So it almost happened parallel to that. And so it was a long time.
I can see that for you, because you're such an instinctive actor.
Yeah.
And I mean, I told you that the other day, and it's the truth. We're touring with Agatha Christie, and then there were none in China, which in itself, what the hell? You know, how did we get here? That's a whole other story. But last week, what I witnessed, the last show I've seen, was a masterclass in acting, and I stand by my words, because we've now been doing the show together for almost 3 months. And you, everything new that you brought to the table on that night is what you're talking about, is actually things that are unfathomable to another person's brain. I would never have thought of those things. It's not an intellectual process, but you were on stage and you just knew what needed to be done.
Yeah.
And every new thing just added some spice to the scene. But never diverted from anyone else, never diverted from the story, never diverted from the action. It was always the little bit of extra thing that made it real as well. You're really, really good at just doing something that makes it real.
And that goes back to that first story that I told you about, which was the way I wanted the people in the Wizard of Oz, in that college, to feel was, yeah, they've just seen loads of people with big voices dressed as animals and things like that. But I wanted them to feel like, how did one of us get up there?
Yeah.
How did one of us get to be on stage and not know which wardrobe to open? Mm. And I still want that in everything that I've ever done. I did it in Matilda, and now I'm trying to do it in this. It's like, yeah, we see we're watching an Agatha Christie play, but how did that fool get up there?
But Shakespeare has incredible parts. Incredible parts like that.
Yeah.
I understand how, you know, you made the parallel sign with your hand. Yeah. But I understand how it must feel. How do I make this very constrictive piece of work that I have to fit in, almost like a costume that's old and starched and doesn't fit and smells funny?
Yeah.
How do I make that feel real?
Yeah.
How do I make this Elizabethan ruff feel real to my dad?
Yeah, that's it.
He won't buy that.
That's right.
So what's the...
Yeah.
What's the answer to that?
And many people have asked me. I've been so blessed. I've had Catherine Hunter wanted me for Dogberry. Jesse Rourke wanted me just before this for Andrew Aguecheek.
Of course, Andrew Aguecheek.
So many times it's nearly happened. But usually it's me that sabotages it. Usually it's me that goes, no, because there was something that was set from around that age in my head, which was that's not for me. That's for other people to do. And I think I am literally just one collaborator away from going, oh, that's just like, that was just a trick of the light. That's not something that's real. That was just an unhelpful thought that happened a really, really long time ago. But unfortunately, there is also a truth in this country, which is unless you get a bit of help like that, unless you're lucky to meet that person. I mean, we both know Katie Stevens. I know she's a great hero of yours. And I've talked to her about this. And, you know, she was lucky enough to meet someone who did that for her. She believes that she would never have gone down that road without that person. I just don't think I met that person at the right time. And then just years and years go past and then you just kind of don't do it.
I'm really passionate about changing people's minds, you know, people who think it's not for them, people who say it's not for them. It's just such a tragedy because actually what it needs, what we desperately need right now is more people who think it's not for them. Do it so that the audience who thinks it's not for them can see you on stage and go, but how did that guy get up there?
Yeah.
That's what I want to do. I want real people. Because I'm a real person. I come. Nothing helped me get up here. But I went, oh my God, of course it's for me, because I get it.
Yeah.
And I think because I wasn't raised in England, I think it was a huge help for me. Because I didn't have this notion that Shakespeare's for posh people.
Yeah.
And in Eastern Europe, everyone, it's your right to have access to great literature and to feel that it's for you.
Yeah.
There's not such a class system so embedded still in the fabric of society.
Yeah. It bothers me. It bothers me, that thing of like, you know, I've been to Stratford. I've been to see shows there. I've visited the place and I just didn't feel comfortable.
Wow.
And it's just because I didn't know any middle class people when I was growing up. And it's hard to shake. In a way, it became the engine of my work. I do feel like a fish out of water there. Having said that, I did do Richard III at college. We did it as a module. We all had to learn the Queen and sing, the Lady and sing. I enjoyed doing it, but I never really felt like I conquered it when we had to do it in front of like an audience and stuff like that. And then a few months later, I went on a camping trip to a very beautiful place near Manchester called Edale. And it's up in the hills and far away from anything. And I was really drunk. And I was really drunk. And I happened to be there with someone who knew the lines, who had done that scene, who had played the Anne character. We played it when we were drunk. And it was astonishing. It was just like,
I bet it worked.
It worked because, like you say, it's not about your head. It's not about thoughts. It's about it's rapping, isn't it?
It's rapping. It's absolutely right. Damn straight it's rapping.
Yeah, it is. And I really went with it, and it was because I was drunk. So that was a door.
So that part of your brain didn't have the space to go, no, it's not for you.
I think I'm just really prejudiced, actually. I think I was brought up with a lot of prejudice. And when I hear people do a big voice and start to do it, I just think that's just silly.
It's the voice that's really interesting as well. So when I teach Shakespeare,
yeah,
students, you know, I kind of sit everyone down in a circle like I do, and then I go, all right, so let's go around the circle, and before we start this module, let me know what you're most excited about and what you're most afraid of.
Yeah.
And I write down everyone. And all these drama school students start talking about the voice, the Shakespeare voice. Yeah, so I'm really excited to find this Shakespeare voice. Or on the other hand, some people go, oh, but I don't want to do the Shakespeare voice. And it seems to be a thing that we've accepted, that there is a Shakespeare voice that you have to do and speak like this. And it's fascinating, isn't it?
We were brought up with Olivier.
Is that the voice you hear when you hear the Shakespeare voice?
That's the one. That one and Gielgud, yeah, those are the two. And then Burton just sort of echoed them. And it's a very particular kind of thing.
Do you think we're still trying to do that?
There's still a lot of people who pawn over that.
Yeah.
Voice pawn.
It's
true. There's a lot of people who think that's, you know, right. There's a lot of people who teach it still who think that's right.
And it's right or wrong, isn't it? It's that as well. There's a lot of that word being thrown around. What's right and what's... What do you think of the iambic pentameter? You're talking about rapping.
I love it. To me, it's just melody.
You're so musical. So for you, a piece of Shakespeare must be just like a song?
Yes.
Yeah.
Everything's a song, isn't it, though? Everything. Everything is. This podcast is. To me, it's just music. And maybe it's different in other countries. Maybe in other countries... people will listen to our conversation and go, I don't get it, what are you even talking about? But take it from me. It's like, in this country, because he's from here and we own him and he's our biggest export, well, Beatles maybe, people are hung up about it. They're just really hung up. And people in drama schools are hung up about it, and people who do a lot of it are hung up about it. And it just turned me off. I just didn't want to be hung up about it. So I just kind of thought, well, I just leave them all over there hung up about it. But I do love Shakespeare. Of course I do. And I do wonder if... I tell you what, at its worst, I feel like I'll never be a proper actor until I've done loads of it.
Oh, I see. Yeah, of course there's that as well. That TV show with the silly man who's like, you know, you're not a proper actor until you've done the Globe.
Right. And yet, I know, because they're friends of mine, the Shakespearean actors feel like they're not proper actors because they've not been on EastEnders.
Can you do both? Do you think actors can do both? Do you think actors can be both really good on EastEnders and really good at Shakespeare?
Yes, I do.
What do you think would make you do it? Like, what set of circumstances would make you say yes to a role, to a Shakespeare role?
Oh, no, I'm ready. I wouldn't come and speak to you today about this if I wasn't ready.
What role would you like to play?
Bottom. I'd like to play Bottom because I think it's an easy start because I wouldn't have to deal with the verse.
That's fair.
I could just do the prose, and that would be enough for me to begin with. I almost need that Wizard of Oz experience again. I need to be around people doing the verse and think, oh, wow, they seem like they're having a really nice time. And then from there, that would be my kind of jumping off point into everything else. But I'm glad, you know me, I'm also very like, I don't really believe in regrets. I think everything's perfect. I think it's all was always meant to be like this for me. I'm not one of those people walking around like with a migraine because I didn't play Hamlet or Romeo. I'm just not.
No.
I know that the timing of this was always meant to be like this. But yeah, I'm ready. I would like the second half of my career to be much more classical. Because
yeah.
I'm not hung up about it anymore.
Oh, I see. Do you think you could do it without being hung up about it?
Yeah. I couldn't have done it without being hung up about it. I would have been a nightmare. I would have had such a chip on my shoulder. Got fired, you know. It would have been terrible.
Just fire that guy.
Yeah.
Can't do it anymore.
He's got such a problem with us. What's his problem, man?
I just can see it happening as well.
Yeah. God, when I did my big voice, he went really fucking nuts.
So, like, again, there's loads of people out there, especially younger people, who feel and think exactly the way you've described so wonderfully. What would you say to them? What do you think we can do to bring them into the fold?
I think I was a product of my time. I'm 51. You know, I grew up at exactly the time when all of this was the problem. It's changed, and it's taken me time to realise that it's changed, and I think it is much more open now, and I just say don't be scared of it just because it's something that posh people used to do. Be open to everything, that's what I would say. It's taken me a long time, because I'm not a very open person. I had to be pushed on stage, and if I hadn't, that's why I'm always really grateful. You know how I feel about the audience. I'll always be grateful to the audience. Because of that experience I had that evening. If they hadn't told me who I was, I may never have known. I might have spent the rest of my life just wandering around, not knowing what I was doing. And I think laughs are really important, actually. Some actors as well, I would like to say this on the record, some actors are very like, oh, it's not about laughs. It is about laughs, because laughs are the only way that any audience can tell you I understand what you're doing. They only get one vote, which is sit there in silence or just go, ha! And if you hear anyone in an audience go, ha, that means they're saying, do that again, I like that, I understand what you're doing. It's clear what you're thinking. And if they're sitting there in silence, don't walk off stage and say, oh shit, audience. Like, no, you're shit because you're not clear. There's something about what you're doing which isn't clear, and that's why they didn't laugh. If it was clear, they'd go, ha, which means do it again. I like that. I actually understand what your character's thinking. And it's not about being funny. Being funny is whatever. But it's about being clear. And an audience will laugh if it's clear.
It's about, a lot of what you're saying really resonates with me in that contract we have with the audience and the respect you afford an audience.
Yeah.
It's not diminishing the fact that you have a bunch of really intelligent, normal human beings who've actually taken time out of their lives and paid money to be there.
Yeah.
So it's respecting that contract on the other side of it and going, I'm going to do my best to honour that relationship. And I'm wondering, you know, you were saying you saw a lot of bad Shakespeare.
Yeah, I did.
I really want to know, why do you think, what do you think made it bad?
It was boring. I don't think it's acceptable to keep people in a theatre for 3 hours without any laughs. I don't think it's acceptable. I think that's called torture. And I'm not interested in going to watch anything that just makes me scratch my head. There's two things that I want to feel in a theatre. I want to feel, this is so delightful, I never want it to end. God, I hope this never ends, because I'm laughing so much, I love my life. Or, this is going to kill me, and I'm going to crawl out of here. Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller make me feel like that. This is actually going to kill me, this play. Because it hurts. Let's make it stop. That now, the dream is to be in something that makes you feel both, right? And I've actually been in that a few times, so I'm very blessed. But too many times I've been to watch things in a theatre for 3 hours and I haven't laughed once, and I've come out and I've heard people say, well, that's interesting. If you hear anyone say that's interesting, that means that translates into that's not interesting. Because if the best thing you can say about an evening in a theatre is, well, that was interesting, it wasn't interesting, it was boring.
I've been in so many places where people go, oh, interesting. I'm like, no, you're trying to think of something interesting to say about it. Because it wasn't interesting. You're so right. There's something about what we do with Shakespeare, isn't it? What we think we should do. What we do and what we're allowed to do. And what, what makes it interesting.
Yeah. There's two things that it can be. It can be dead or it can be alive. Always, with everything. Agatha Christie, anything.
Yeah. How do we make sure we make it alive?
Just don't approach it as if it's a historical thing. Don't approach it as if it's an old thing. Don't approach it like it was written 400 and whatever years ago. Mm. You approach it as if it was a rap that was written 2 seconds ago.
Yeah.
So, but never ever forget that. And someone said this to me yesterday. I think it was Jack actually. No, it was Stefan. Stefan said, "Hey man," he said, "I've just worked out that they didn't have fresh water then, so everyone was drunk because they were just drinking beer. Because like no one could afford water, and the water was always dirty. So like all those people at that time, they were just drinking beer." And I was like, "Never forget they were all drunk." And so I just think he would have been a lot of fun to be around.
Absolutely. Because he was part of the company, right? So we're travelling now in a travelling company of players.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing. That guy was there all the time. He was travelling, playing the small roles, trying to figure out how to solve this thing and open the set thing and at the right time. Yeah. And, you know, and if the string breaks, they probably would have sent him.
Yeah, and he something tells me he wasn't precious. I don't know if he would have approved of all that reverence. I don't think he would have found it helpful to write anything. Yeah, and look, at the end of the day, he did write all of those amazing lyrical flights of profound amazingness. But he also wrote Bottom. And he also knew what it was like to be funny. He was a comedian.
One of the things that surprises and delights me the most about Shakespeare is that you'll go see Midsummer Night's Dream, the most performed play in the world. Mm-hmm. Right now, at this very moment, somebody somewhere is saying Bottom's line.
Yeah.
Somebody somewhere is performing Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
And somebody else is laughing. There's something about it. We've all seen it about 17 times. And it works. It works. You can't do it wrong.
Yeah.
I've seen it done by children, by 8-year-olds, and you're pissing yourself because it works. I've seen Comedy of Errors. 425-year-old jokes just land.
Right. And what's the most popular thing in the West End now? One of them is that play that goes wrong thing. He wrote that first. He wrote that. So he was the man that wrote the wall thing. That's someone who's really, really funny. That's a funny man. He had to pitch that to the company and go, "Look, you know, this is
funny. Now we'll lie to the chink." Yeah, it's really funny.
He would have loved all of the rapping. He would have been excited by that. He would have responded to it. I know he would. You can feel it in his work that there's a tempo and a musicality and just he's a correspondent. I think that's what people forget about him. It's that, like Dickens and like all these other writers, that he was a correspondent. He was writing things down that he could see, and like young Paul Weller in the Jam, he's just writing things down. He wrote them down better than anyone else, that's a fact. But, you know, he was stealing and taking from everywhere, we know that.
That's just life, that's writing. That's what you do, that the English teacher said you do so well. You're really good at describing life the way it really is, and what life is complicated and messy, yeah, and ugly and smelly and weird and bizarre, and not this kind of pretty perfect, yeah, thing that always falls on the beat.
Yeah, and he did that better than anyone, that thing of noticing those little contradictions. And, you know, Hamlet's all about that, isn't it? It's beautiful. It's really beautiful. What a mind. I mean, what more can you say, really? What a mind. You know,
yeah.
Graced with that mind. It was such a blessing that it was written down.
I mean, I'm very happy with this. I think we've solved it, really. You're welcome, America. Thank you for your time. Thank you, China. Thank you, America. Thank you, world. We've just solved all of the Shakespeare problems. So, I mean, that was a good day at work for us. You still have a show to do tonight. Like, that's just bonus. That was so wonderful, Michael. I didn't know what to expect from talking to you, but I knew it was going to be kind of like this. I knew we were going to solve it, but without really trying.
Well, yeah.
It's just easy. Not be hung up about it.
Yeah. No, you've made me really want to do Shakespeare.
Yes.
Just from, not even just today, just from being around you, and like you are that person who did that jig, and the fact you're so passionate about him and the work, it's really made me look at it again, and I'm up for it. It's taken me a really long time, to admit that to myself, that I am. Not just because I want to be a proper actor, but because I think it's taken me this long to be ready, really. You know?
That means a lot, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
That means a lot, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm excited to come see you do some Shakespeare. I can't wait. It'd
be amazing, wouldn't it?
I'm bringing everyone to see it. I'm bringing all the kids to see it. The kids need to see you do some Shakespeare. Because look, one of us got up there.
How did that fool get up there?
And my final question is always, who do you think I should talk to next?
Well, Terry's the obvious one.
Sir Terence.
Yeah.
Is locked in.
Terry's an interesting one, isn't he? Because he's a good friend of mine now. And he's absolutely just adamant that I need to play all of these parts, which is nice. But he's someone I think who's a real lesson to everyone as well, in that this guy's, for all of you people who don't know, he's 81. And he's worked with everyone, done everything. But he rarely leans into it. He made a speech the other night because he was asked to, and he did sort of reach back a little bit and said, oh, last time I was here, it was 1979, and did all that stuff. But he rarely does that on an everyday basis, and that's very impressive. He's not a backward-looking person, Terry. He's very much up to date and stays that way, and he's one of the quickest people I know. He said to me yesterday, Begley, you're the only person who's ever had to go to see a physio for overacting. He said that to me. And that was really made me laugh out loud. And that's so typical of him, to be that playful and offensive.
Playful and offensive.
He's never settled and just being like, I'm an elder statesman now. He's always one of the naughtiest people in the company.
Oh, absolutely.
Always. And so I love that about him. And he's very forward thinking. And he's very now and he's very today. I think that's an incredible example, 81. And to still have the energy that he has in doing the play that we're doing at the moment. But I would love to hear you unravel him in a longer conversation and get him into talking about Shakespeare and his thoughts on it and reflect on it, because I think he would agree with us that it's not something to be reverent about.
He's the most irreverent.
Yeah.
Actor I've yeah. ever met.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
I love the fact that he's so playful. I said to him last week, actually, I said, oh, I've had all these days off, I really don't want to go back to work. He said, don't go back to work. He said, go back to playing. He said, it's a totally different mindset then. And he's right, it is. And that's the beauty of him. So he's an obvious one to talk to. Who would be another really good person to talk to? Obviously, Katie. But I would really like to hear what Lucy Tregear has to say as well.
Mm. Yeah. That's all of that is going to happen, Michael.
Yeah. I can't wait to hear what Bob has to say.
Bob, I can't wait for you to hear what Bob has. I've had to edit my interview with Bob Barrett because it was an hour and 45 minutes. And I managed to get it down to just 1 hour. But I think everybody wants to hear Bob Barrett talk about Shakespeare for an hour.
Bob, you have to play Doctor Who as well.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael. That was welcome. Really wonderful.
Thank you.
Great freaking time.
My pleasure.